All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our panel on the art of crosswords. We're very glad to have you here. We're going to be talking about the American crossword puzzle from the perspective of both constructors and solvers, and thinking about the crossword as an art form with a unique place in our culture. So my name is Robbie Kabbalah. I teach in the philosophy department here at UT Austin, and I've written academic papers on crossword puzzles as an art form, and I'm also a competitive speed crossword solver. And here to help me today are three expert panelists. First, we have Kyle Mahowald, who is a professor in computational linguistics at UT Austin. He started making crossword puzzles in high school, and for a time was the youngest ever constructor of a New York Times Sunday puzzle. In college, don't clap yet. In college, he worked as a summer intern for New York Times crossword editor Will Shortz. And he's more recently drawn on his academic expertise to write a piece for The Atlantic about crosswords and linguistics. And he's currently working on getting AI to solve crosswords. Next up, we have Adrian Raphael, who is a poet, an English professor at Baruch College, CUNY, and the author of the fantastic 2020 book, Thinking Inside the Box, Adventures with Crosswords and the Puzzling People Who Can't Live Without Them. And that is available at the South By bookstore. I encourage you to pick up a copy if you haven't yet. And that book grew out of her dissertation, and it's a fascinating dive into the cultural history of the crossword puzzle from its invention in 1913 to the present. And she is also a constructor, and the puzzle of hers that we have handed out is one that she co-constructed with our final panelist, Natan Last. Natan, this is why I said you shouldn't clap, broke Kyle's record as the youngest ever constructor of a Sunday New York Times
puzzle. We can clap now.
Puzzle. What's that?
No, I'm joking.
Are you still the record holder, or have you since been beaten?
It was broken like 2 weeks after I did it.
Yeah, it's a race to the bottom, I guess. Yeah. Today, Natan is one of the leading crossword constructors of his generation. He regularly writes for The New Yorker, The New York Times, and other top venues. He's also a poet and essayist, and his poetic sensibility is reflected in his crosswords, which have a distinctive modern literary voice. He works by day in humanitarian immigration, and he's also currently working on a book about crosswords called The Electric Grid. Look for that hopefully later this year. So how many people here have ever solved a crossword puzzle? All right, good, lots of solvers. How many people solve them regularly, like once a week or more? Most people here, amazing. Has anyone tried constructing? Any constructors? Any else? A couple people? Okay, amazing, yeah, all right, yeah. So crosswords are having a moment. The flagship American crossword puzzle is the New York Times, and along with Wordle, Spelling Bee, other games you may have heard of, they're the core of their flagship games department. Which has helped the company to pass 10 million paying subscribers, including over 1 million people who subscribe just to the game's app. Last year alone, over 10 million people downloaded the game's app in a major revenue generator for the puzzle. Some people joke that New York Times is a crossword puzzle with a newspaper attached. And for the first time in its history, the puzzle briefly stopped accepting new crossword submissions last summer to deal with their backlog. There's a whole crossword landscape outside the New York Times as well. The Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, both publish a regular crossword, and the New Yorker magazine now publishes 5 crosswords a week. There are indie puzzle outlets as well, like the AV Club, which recently expanded to a 6 times a week word game. Fireball crosswords for super difficult puzzles, the incubator for crosswords made by women and non-binary constructors, and queer crosswords for crosswords made by LGBTQ+ constructors. To say nothing of the many, many talented folks who are creating puzzles on their own personal blogs and websites. So in general, there's just a lot of fresh and diverse voices thinking really differently about the puzzle. But I want to start with a very basic question, and I think we'll start with Natan. So how does a crossword puzzle actually get made?
Yeah, well, on the next slide, you'll see probably the most famous crossword of all time. This is the New York Times puzzle from November 5th, 1996. It was Election Day. This was the year that Bob Dole and Bill Clinton were going head-to-head. And crossword constructor Jeremiah Farrell noticed that Clinton, just the last name, and Bob Dole were both seven letters. And when crossword constructors see things that are similar lengths, they kind of go a little haywire. And in this puzzle, the crossword is acting as though it's predicting who's going to win. So at 39 across, you've got the answer Clinton, and 43 across is elected. But what Farrell had done is that regardless of whether you put in Clinton or Bob Dole, the clues for the down answers worked regardless. So maybe the most famous one, 39 down could be black Halloween animal, and if it was Clinton you'd put in, you got cat, and if it was Bob Dole, you got bat. And so all seven of these crossing answers worked. On the nightly news that day, they were like, the New York Times has predicted the election too soon. It was a bit of a scandal, and then people realized the trick. And so a lot of crosswords start just by saying, how can I turn this quirk of language into a scavenger hunt, something pleasurable for the solver? And so if we were to do that for the group gathered today, on the next slide, I was wondering how you would do a South by Southwest crossword. And so a lot of this just comes down to brainstorming how you can instantiate an idea. I was like, can you get the letters S, X, S, W in a row in longer phrases? There aren't that many because X and W are pretty uncommon letters. So I came up with, you know, the tarot card Six of Swords, the 6 Days War, which is not really what it's called, and Sex Swings, which would be fun to see in a crossword, of course. And then I thought, well, why not just do South By, just the S and the X, and come up with longer answers that started with the S and ended with the X. And in the first slide, you can see, or the first grid, that's just a couple of interesting answers, fresh vocabulary, things I would enjoy putting into a grid and enjoy solving if I were the one solving it. And in the second grid, you see just some of the heuristics that crossword constructors use. X's tend to come at the ends of words, not at the beginning, and so it's good to put a black square underneath the X's. The yellow arrows are indicating high Scrabble value words, so letters that in the game Scrabble have a higher point value, and that's because they're just pretty infrequent in English words, and so those letters tend to play less nicely with surrounding words, and so you kind of try to tuck them away. You try to have them not cross as many words. You put them in the corners, and the V and the F are in places that I think V's and F's tend to go. F's like to start words. The red rectangles are indicating places where two of our theme answers, our theme is South By, so St. Croix and Silver Fox, have at, what is that, 35 down, an answer that's seven letters that has an S in the first position and an R in the second to last. And this is just to illustrate that when you're trying to make a crossword, there's thousands of answers that start with an S and are seven letters. There are a couple hundred that start with an S and have an R in the second to last position. Mm-hmm. And then in the last grid there, it's really just an illustration of what a fun crossword might look like if you were to take this theme to the end and build the grid. Fun answers that are more than one word, which we'll talk a lot about in a bit. The tube in one go, you know, for here, she, they at 41 down. These are just often pieces of modern vocabulary that make the crossword a bit less like a sort of exam that you would see in Latin. And Pi Day, did I do that?
Yeah.
That was an accident.
Happy Pi Day.
So Pi Day is there. It's just fun to see answers that, again, you can have a serendipitous association with the day you solve, but also just fresh vocabulary that sits nicely next to pop culture and so on.
So Kyle, can you tell us a little bit more about what makes for a good crossword answer?
Yeah, so I guess Natan talked a bit about starting with the theme, getting the theme in, and then there are all these other answers that go into the grid. And if you've solved a puzzle, you might have some intuitions that some of them are better than others. And there's also things that you probably just wouldn't see in a puzzle. So I wanted to give a kind of bit of intuition about like what makes a good answer. So besides just having a theme, what's a good non-theme kind of entry in a crossword? And so typically, like when you're constructing a puzzle, the kinds of things you're thinking about are how can I make the non-theme answers, you know, fresh, colloquial, modern, interesting, like Natan was saying, in the language kinds of answers. So if I were to say, you know, this is a New York Times crossword clue fairly recently, annual multimedia festival informally, four letters. I think the crowd here might have a guess. right, and so it is SXSW, which is especially, right, on the topic of having something which is familiar to the audience. I think this should be familiar to all of you. It might be less familiar to other kinds of audiences, right? And so there's always a question of audience in the puzzle, but I think this is a fun answer, right? It's got like an interesting letter combination that you don't often see, a word starting with SX, and it's a kind of, you know, modern and interesting. A famous example of a less successful answer in a New York Times crossword puzzle is this one, which is town at the 8th mile of the Boston Marathon. And so if you click through, I just heard the answer, but right. So if you had blank A-T-I-C-K, and then this was crossing this answer, Treasure Island Illustrator, which was blank C Wyatt, and some of you probably have a guess of what this is, and others of you might not have a guess. And this is a really flexible spot in the grid where kind of lots of different letters could go there, right? So maybe like Tadic or Madic and MC Wyeth, like basically any letter can go in blank C Wyeth if you don't know it. And lots of consonants can go in that first position. Right, the actual answer is Natick and NC Wyeth. And this has now become a term in the crossword industry. A Natick is now a crossing, which if you don't know it, if you don't know at least one of them, you're just not going to get it. Right? And that's something we want to typically avoid when making a crossword. Right? We want it to be the case that once you get the answer, you kind of know you've gotten it, and you're not left in this position of uncertainty. So the last piece I'll say about this is this in the language. Right? So I think this is a phrase that gets tossed around a lot when thinking about non-theme answers, is the answer should be in the language. And it's really great to have these kind of multi-word phrases which are in the language. But it's not just the case that any of them kind of work. And so in the crossword world, green paint is the kind of term that gets used for answers which, yes, they're phrases, yes, they refer to something, but they're not quite an in-the-language unit of the kind that you would see in a crossword. Right? So Green Day, on the other hand, right, that's perfectly fine for a crossword. That's the band, so you know, American Idiot Band or whatever. Green tea, that's somewhere in between, right? So green paint, if you know what the green means and you know what paint means, you basically know what green paint means, right? There's nothing more to it than that. And that makes it kind of unsatisfying as an answer. Green tea, if you know what green means and you know what tea means, you might imagine something like this. And that would be like kind of getting green tea wrong, right? It has some meaning which isn't just...
What is that?
Strictly, that's if you put into Dolly green tea. Right, so this is like not strictly recoverable what green tea is. Whereas like, right, the actual thing you might want to be thinking of is something like this, which to know what this is, you need to, it's like kind of green, right? But it's not, you need to know something more than just the meaning of green and tea. And so good crossword answers that are multi-word phrases, I think have this property that you know a bit more about them.
So we're getting a bit more about what makes for a good crossword answer. Adrian, you wrote a chapter in your book about your own experience starting out in crossword constructing. Any tips for the folks who might want to try their hand at constructing a new puzzle?
Yeah, and actually, I'm going to give hot tips that are not in the book because, like, do not do as I did, do as I say. I am not on the youngest Sunday New York Times constructor. I came to constructing after reading about crosswords, sort of casually solving, learning about the history and language, and I came to it as like, great, I love language, I love words, I love word games, I could totally make a crossword puzzle, it'll take me an afternoon. No, it takes longer. I think the first thing to know if you are, if you have never constructed a crossword before. You've solved them, you love them, you hate them, you're indifferent to them, but if you've never solved one, or if you've never constructed one before, the first place to start is, well, the first thing to really think about is like a grid. And I didn't realize this going in. I thought, great, I'll have a beautiful theme. I'll have 20 different theme answers. Therefore, I'll have most of my crossword constructed. No, that's actually the backwards approach, because when you have 20 different theme answers, they're all gonna like cross each other in a grid, as we saw with Natan's demonstration. And that's gonna create for a big ol' mush and tangle in the center. Yeah. So the thing that you really want to do is play around with grids and play around with mini grids, play around with smaller ones so that you can start to get a feel for what letters play nicely with each other in combination, how does symmetry work. There's some really amazing and totally free software and websites available online where you can do this now. The one that we've been looking at that we've seen on here is a downloadable one, which is not free, but you pay a one-time thing called Crossfire. And if you get more seriously into crossword construction, you probably do want to download that because you can import your word list, which we will talk about in a second. But if you're just starting off, I want to play around with it and I want to use grids to help me, and which like 100% of constructors do. There's Crosserville, there's Crosshair, there's other great ones online, but those two jump to mind because they'll help you out with the symmetry of it. Actually, some of them, Crosserville helps you out with fill and clues too, and then Crosshair has a really robust community of people who have just, you know, like you, just like me, they start their first puzzle and they throw it up online and they say, hey, I've never constructed a puzzle before. Can somebody else solve this for me and tell me what you think? Because that is another, like, the most incredible way to start crosswords, and the most incredible thing about crosswords is the crossword community. So once you get interested in how grids work and how crosswords work, I would encourage you to really start playing around with these tools online and then very quickly start connecting with people in the crossword community who are always hungry to help newbie solvers.
Yeah, so maybe we can talk a bit more about kind of the use of technology in creating the modern puzzle. We've got some other slides here. I do want to show a very pretty grid. This is one of Natan's grids from last year in the New York Times. Just a really, really nice kind of spiral shape there. But does anyone want to comment on this amazing
post? I mean, crossword constructors are just like ridiculous collectors of odd letter patterns. And when someone with an odd letter patterned name begins to get famous, or a fictional character with an odd lettered patterned name, we love it.
I mean, if you go back a slide, also, like, we were talking about, like, what makes a good answer, right? We have all these answers, like, South by Southwest and green tea and what multi-word phrases. Like, you then might have the question, like, why is the crossword then full of stuff like this? So these are the most common 3- and 4-letter answers in crosswords. It's, like, era and air and one and ale and or and area and eerie and area and allo and anti. And, like, if you've solved a lot of puzzles or even a few puzzles, you've probably seen these words, like, more times than you really want to.
This is like a structural thing about sort of English phonotactics. I don't know if we want to do the black square heat map, but this is one of my favorite images. Sorry.
No, you're good.
But they basically, green tea, there was a lovely software engineer at the New York Times Games Department who put together this visual which says, hey, give me all of the crossword grids that have ever been published in the New York Times on Monday. If there's a black square in that cell, darken it a teeny bit, right? So the darker these sort of ghostly imprints of crosswords are, the likelier there is to be a black square in that cell. And the reason you can see things like little stair steps on Thursday, right, these diagonals, and the diagonals go from the lower left to the lower right, to the upper right. And the reason for that is that English, just structurally, something like 80% of the words in English start with a consonant. And so you want consonants like J to start a word going across, but then also start another word going down, right? Are there words that end in J? For sure. But there are, again, many orders of magnitude more words that begin with J. So your consonants tend to be at the beginning of words, and they are encouraged by this stair step. The release valve to that are the vowel-heavy aiolis and oreos that we just saw. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, do you want to talk about Noah Veltman's thing?
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say that, like, so I like the vowel-heavy word, so that's where the crossword ease comes in. It's this Noah Veltman, this is, like, from a few years ago now, but it's the principle still holds of this kind of the statistics of what are the words that are the most crosswordy words? So they appear the most heavily in crosswords as a ratio versus where they appear in the language. And yeah, you want these super vowel heavy words because they just make your puzzle a lot more flexible. And there was a meme going around recently, I think with when Taylor Swift announced her new, dropped the album, of like, please call it Airy or Aria or Sea.
Yeah. Like, yeah. It's like after Eras Tour, she needs to have an Ali Tour, an Eras Tour.
Exactly, exactly. So like these are, I feel like in dictionary world, there's like the most senior dictionary people are the ones who find a new definition for like go or God or a or the or something that's like an incredibly common word, and actually it's the most difficult to find that new nuanced definition for it. It's a big celebration in like Merriam-Webster land where it's like, we got number like 37A for God and it's different from 37B. So I feel like in cluing world, if we can find, and we can talk about this later too, but if we can find new angles to like relevantly clue Eerie in somewhere, aria that are if somebody, you know, and that are different but and fresh and yet still gettable and within crossword logic, that's a boon for crossword constructors everywhere.
If you're thinking of having a baby, please name them Anna, E-N-A, and then make them famous so we can put them in the crossword. We would really appreciate
it. Issa Rae, we love.
Yes, exactly. We stand. So I think, Natan, you wanted to talk a little bit more about kind of the use of technology and these three main components of the crossword.
So the three big components of a crossword are what the grid looks like, what the theme is, and what the clues are. And they're sort of seized upon by very different mindsets, I would say. This is a collection of grids by Malaika Honda. She's a software engineer, a trained statistician, and she discovered that the number of valid, so like crossword legal, 7x7 grids is exactly, basically you could publish one a day except for Sunday over a year. And so she ran this lovely project where she said, here's a Google Sheet, sign up for a day in this year, fill in a grid, and we'll publish them all. And it was this enormous sort of collaborative project. These are all, I'm not going to do 6 times 52 right now, but these are all 6 times 52, 312 puzzles from that year. And it was because she was able to like figure this out mathematically and then generate them all with a computer that this project was even possible. On the next slide, we'll see how software helps brainstorm themes. This is a really fun puzzle from Patrick Berry. He noticed that sore loser, a 9-letter word, every letter appears twice except for the L. And he noticed the same thing about Hippocratic Oath, a nice, interesting, long phrase. Every single letter in Hippocratic Oath appears twice except for the R. If you wanted to come up with more examples of this, it would be really hard, right? It's quite useful to have a tiny little program that just looks through a digital dictionary and says, hey, scroll through all these words. Does every letter except for one appear twice? If so, put that in my basket, and then I'll look at that list and find the interesting ones. Even more so, it'll be useful to have that long list so that you can add a bit of an ornament here. So the leftover letters spell leftovers. The L of sore loser, the E of antiperspirants, and so on. So this is an example where brainstorming with your brain is very fun, but brainstorming alongside computer assistance maybe gets you a more exhaustive and therefore maybe more interesting list. On the next slide, cluing, the last kind of aspect of crossword writing, has been aided by software in a couple of ways. One is a bit hygienic. It's nice to go and see if a clue you've come up with has been published in the Times or other places before. So there are these digital databases that show if you've got a specific answer, what it used to be clued like. But this has turned into a really interesting historiographical exercise where you can see, you know, the first crossword is published in 1913 in the New York World. The Times doesn't start publishing crosswords until World War II in 1942. And so you get abilities to track how a word is understood in the crossword over time. And so this top one, this one is about Mau Mau, who were the rebel fighters in Kenya against British colonizers. In the 1950s, the way that these people were described in the foreign correspondence desks was reflected in the way they were described in the crossword. So you get sort of unsavory clues like native terrorist group, dreaded name, belligerence, menace. And it's not until the 90s and the early aughts and then the 2010s where you get a more updated understanding of what this conflict was about, and Fighters for Kenyan Independence is the clue in 2013. So you can sort of see how the crossword, which is supposed to be like trivia, question, answer, dictionary definition, you know, unassailable meaning, in fact, is just like equally socially constructed.
Yeah, I mean, I think one feature that you could also look for as a solver is the length of a clue, especially when it's introducing something that has not appeared in the puzzle very long.
Yeah.
So this is the example of Stonewall, which used to be clued in the verb meaning sort of to deny or to refuse to cooperate. It has more recently been clued as the Stonewall Inn, the site of the Stonewall riots in New York City. But you can see even from these clues, like 2021, 2023, they're really, really long. There's all this context, right, that has to be added for the solver.
Almost like justifying its use in the puzzle.
And a bit of a byproduct of the internet era in which there is no more column inches to be worried about. And so clues get very long if you can publish them to your blog.
Yeah. Well, who knows? I guess Stonewall Jackson is not getting his due anymore.
Persona non grata, not getting his due. Yeah, he's been exiled.
Yeah. So this is a puzzle on the art, a panel on the art of crosswords. And you might sort of wonder whether crossword puzzles really are an art or an art form. And Will Shortz, the New York Times editor, was asked this question a while back. And here's what he said, quote, "I think it's a minor art form. And only in the modern days, if you go back 40 or 50 years, crosswords were just collections of words. They were a nice craft. But the constructor's personality wasn't really coming through in the puzzle. I think that's part of what makes something an art. It's the human nature of it. The person's personality is expressed through the form." So I want to ask you all if you agree with Shortz that it's a minor art form and only recently. And maybe we'll start with you, Adrian. You've written a lot about the history of the puzzle.
Yeah, I think that the crossword... I'm biased. I think it's a major art. I think that the crossword has always been deeply related to art. And if we just kind of back up for a second and kind of zoom out from, we've been in the weeds a little bit of like getting really in the weeds with how do you do it, what is it? But if we just kind of back up and say, well, wait, what is this artifact of society, and what is this technology that we have built that is the crossword puzzle? It is an aesthetic object, and I think almost first and foremost, the relationship you have to the crossword is the visual grid. And after this panel, hopefully you will start having the effect that I had when I was writing my book, where I was looking at anything that was sort of vaguely square-like, and it's like, oh my god, it's a crossword. I would look up at the ceiling here and be like, wow, it's a lot of black squares. And then these weird big 15ers, grid spanners. So I think that the crossword, truly, guys, the crossword, though, as aesthetic object, has an extremely clear appeal because it's iconic, black and white squares. So I love all the fashion examples of it, and crosswords and fashion have had this intersection, especially like since the 1920s, when in 1913 the crossword was invented. In 1924 the crossword becomes really popular when the first anthology of crossword puzzles was published, the Crossword Puzzle Book. It was the first book that the publisher Simon & Schuster published. They published it under a different name because they weren't sure whether it was going to sell. It sold like mad. It became a fad. And then in true 20 style and in true fad style, it also entered fashion and has never left. So this this image on the left here, this scarf actually was designed by the crossword puzzle constructor and magician David Kwong. Yeah, he collaborated with Diane von Furstenberg because she decided that for her 50th anniversary collection, what could be more iconic than a crossword puzzle visually? So she worked with David Kwong to make this scarf, and then there's like crossword stuff and other in throughout the collection. These the pictures in that are early, some of those early crossword flapper kind of dudes. That one with the box hat and the capelet is some kind of Parisian thing that is maybe my favorite crossword fashion thing of all time. Lisa Perry, the designer, did a 2015 collection that had riffed on crosswords. That Barbie crossword puzzle is from the 70s. I'm just, you know, I'm a little sad there wasn't some sort of hot pink, like, time. What, did I miss there? Was there, like, a Kennergy crossword? And the New York Times crossword were the only publication, or the only brand that did not do a collab with Barbie. Did they miss out?
Yeah, they definitely missed out on that brand collaboration, yeah.
But... No, but so that's the kind of zoomed out version of the crossword as aesthetic object is, I think, deeply connected to art. And there's all, and 1913, 1924, modernism. So if we ever want to talk about the modernism and modern art and grids and Mondrian and, you know, and crosswords, it's all there.
Yeah, I think that's on here. I think the grid stuff is on here somewhere.
Well, here we have on the right. I know this was a crossword that Vladimir Nabokov made,
yeah.
Right, for his wife.
So like, so grid art. I mean, we'll talk about this, but like, yeah. This is a really early example of both grid art and art as grid. So Nabokov, the author of Lolita and lots of other amazing. Works and also famously a butterfly collector and a butterfly lover and also famously wordplay freak. he created the first crosswords in the Russian language, or the first like documented crosswords in the Russian language, and he used crosswords to this image of a butterfly cross is also a really early example of exactly the thing that Shorts was talking about of crosswords reflecting people's personalities and saying that that wasn't happening earlier. I think Shorts is right that that is more visible in mainstream puzzles today more than ever. However, this was still a thing from the origin of the form. So Nabokov loves butterflies. He makes a crossword in the shape of a butterfly for his wife. His wife was recovering from an illness, and so he was sending her kind of like a newspaper entry about his day. And he's like, well, a newspaper, it has to have a crossword in it. So, and he like, I think he bakes in little Easter eggs to his wife in there. So this is, it's his love language, and this is a perfectly functional crossword. I think I don't speak Russian, but I think I trust Nabokov, and it's just and it's so filled with personality.
Yeah.
Can I ask you, I guess, as a philosophy of art question, Robbie, which is that on this like minor art topic, one of the things that I think makes crosswords a bit different from what we historically think of as art is that there's this role the solver plays of kind of filling in the grid and doing this exercise, which I guess maybe video games, which have similar kinds of questions come up. Do you have thoughts from the kind of philosophy of art perspective?
I'm inclined to agree with Adrian that this in no way undermines crossword status as a major art form. I mean, the mere fact that something is designed for an audience to receive it, and I think people in this room will agree with me, does not undermine its ability to be an incredible work of art in its own right.
Relevant, I think, that David Kwong was there, because magic and comedy, like crosswords, need to have that same quick solve time squell, and you get feedback right away. It's not like a book or a movie, but the audience participates right away and lets you know if it's good.
Yeah. I mean, there was actually a defense of the idea of the stunt puzzle by the crossword blogger Jim Horn. So like an example of a stunt puzzle is something which is intuitively for the constructor's own pleasure. So there was a puzzle not that long ago where every clue began with the same letter. And you might not even have noticed this. Like, I didn't notice it as I was solving this.
It's going too fast.
Maybe not too fast. But the idea is that, like, well, I didn't enjoy that, so what's the point? And anyways, this blogger, Jim Horn, said, no other art form comes with this expectation that you have to please the solver. Can you imagine a painter or sculptor or opera composer being told that rather than do what pleases them, they should only innovate within comfortable standard forms? Do you all agree with him?
I mean, the analogy is interesting because at the end of the day, the crossword is solved. And so some people think that it's not as open to interpretation as other art forms. You look at a sculpture and you say, I see this, and someone else might see something else. I actually think the crossword community has been very good at, you know, when Twitch streamers live stream their solve, it is so lovely to watch people crack a crossword from a different angle. Yeah. Someone might know a singer first and get a certain corner fast, and someone else might have a literature background and get the southeast corner faster. And so you're seeing people deploy their knowledge and their ability to solve and their agency in solving live. And so I think it is open to...
And that's very much the ideal from the solve, like the constructing yes. perspective. You want solvers to have multiple entryways into the grid. And so I think that's kind of the most satisfying is maybe a hard Saturday puzzle. Someone could look at it and go through and maybe know one or two answers and think, oh man, I'm never going to get through this. And then once you get those one or two answers, you start building on it and realizing that you actually know more than you think you did. And by the end, you have this completed solution and feel this sense of accomplishment, which is, I think, kind of like peak solving experience in a lot of ways.
I remember the first time I realized this, I think from both of these angles, is going to my first crossword puzzle tournament. So at many crossword puzzle tournaments, including like the ACPT, the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament, the finals of the tournament, you have people solving live online and you are on a stage and you watch them solve. So it's very much like this live Twitch streaming, but you watch them solve live. And there's also another really beautiful thing that happens at several tournaments where the final crossword, because there's kind of different tiers of levels of people solving for the grand finale. And so the final crossword grid, it will be one grid, but it will have three different sets of clues to that grid. And so I think this actually comes at the question of crosswords as an art form and crosswords interaction with the solver. Really, like, I love it from both angles because seeing it at a tournament was the first time that I had realized, I really kind of rationally grokked, like, oh, wow, a grid, a filled grid can be clued three total, or three, or four, or 18, or infinite, not infinite, but like many, many, many different ways. And that creates a very different experience of solving it because you can have a grid that's, you know, clued so much, or it can be easier for one group of people or for one kind of solver than other ones. And that was such a beautiful nature of the art form to me. And then also, as you guys were saying, watching people's minds at work solving the puzzle, because they solve it with their backs to the audience, so you can watch them and realize, oh, wow. And I think also the tenseness of the mistake. You're like, oh, wow. And then like, sort of watching, and also watching where people's like logic fails too, or it succeeds. They're too good at it, so they're going too fast. They fill it in and they make a mistake, and then
it's only a room of 700 people gasping when someone writes an L instead of a T.
Yeah. So then also watching the audience in its own art form, and so I think that like, but that was a really like crystal illustration of both of those streams for me. Yeah.
Yes, we've talked a lot about kind of voice in the ways in which constructors can get their own voice in through the answers they include, but also through the ways in which they clue things, to Adrian's point just now. But I mean, I did want to talk a little bit about this dimension of the visuals, what's sometimes called grid art. And I mean, I sort of wonder, you know, here's some kind of classic examples of puzzles famous for their visual appeal. And I kind of want to ask you all, I mean, does this matter? Is this something that solvers should even care about or notice?
Yeah.
Does it make a puzzle better when there is this visual aesthetic?
Well, there are a couple ways to answer this. So actually, I would say the two puzzles on the left are quite different. I think they're stark. They look like a beautifully designed tile. And so they have that aesthetic intensity to them. The reason they look like that is because these two puzzles are playing a kind of arithmetic optimization game where they want to have as few words as possible in a grid. And for a while, among annoying constructors like Kyle and I, we were like, I can't wait to see how many few words we can put in a grid. And this was a bit of a race to the bottom, in fact. And it's a race that I think, as a solver, you might not at all notice.
And even might come to resent, in that if you look at some of these grids, right, the words that are going in there in order to achieve this low word count start to kind of get stretchier and
it leads
push
to
the
compromises,
boundaries
exactly.
Of like what a good answer is.
There's a famous crossword, speaking of like, are you alienating the solver, that only uses the letter E, not dissimilar from like a Wiley Poe constraint-based writing thing, and you're like, it's cool.
Well, E is the only vowel.
The only vowel.
E's the only vowel, sorry, E's the only vowel. It's all E's. It's just scream when you see a mouse. it's quite fun to look at it. And I actually think something we talk about a lot is looking at a puzzle's grid before having solved it and admiring it aesthetically. I think the same is true for afterwards. I used to love getting the Saturday crossword from the Times in print and looking at the grid of the Friday, the answers that are printed below it, and saying, those are interesting words next to each other. That's a found poem. It's just cool to see vocabulary from different registers, from different walks of life, rub elbows just because they have interesting and pairing letter combinations. But then, at the same time, the grid art aspect can be something that's asked of the solver. So in the top row middle puzzle, this is a Sunday puzzle themed after the treachery of images. So Cecina Pompeep, the French for this is not a pipe, is there in circled letters, and there's a little note at the top of this puzzle when it appeared in the Times that said, hey, when this puzzle is done, connect these letters in this order to get a special image, and you in fact draw the pipe that way. The panda's just cute. That's all I have to say about the panda.
I think the panda's cute. Some people don't quite see the panda. So the panda's in the top right, and you can kind of come in and out of focus a bit. I see it as a cute panda.
I cannot see it.
Really?
Yeah.
Some people see it as a kind of like there's some version of it where it looks like a kind of like evil jack-o'-lantern.
One thing that's fun about the panda puzzle and worth noting is that it has what's called unchecked squares. So 17 across is panda. The P and A of panda don't have a down answer that they cross. And so famously in American-style crosswords, just like it's like the opposite of a nadic. It's considered a kindness to your solver to, of course, have every answer be in an across answer and then also be checked by a down answer. So every solver has two fighting chances. In a sense, it is checked because it looks like a panda.
I was going to say that it really is checked because, like, you know panda is the right answer because
that's
the panda's in the grid, and so you, like, have this second route into it.
That's, like, I heard somebody comment on the spiral puzzle that's underneath it, so that puzzle, to just go really, like, the art of grid art, this is a puzzle that's about the Guggenheim Museum, and so the Guggenheim Museum in New York you go up the spiral staircase, that is the architecture of the museum, and then that Liz Gorski, who's sort of a god tier of the grid art puzzle, designed this. So she also has art hanging along the spiral staircase, as though it's like Picasso I see on there, and I think there's other artists that are like hanging along the spiral staircase, as mimicking the form of being in that museum. So I think that grid art that does something, and all of these are adding differently to the puzzle. So the experience of the Guggenheim puzzle is like enhanced by the grid art, and it's also like required. Like that is part of the shtick of the puzzle. That's part of the solver's interaction with it, is that you are entering the Guggenheim.
Yeah. So we want to have some time for questions, and there's a mic here, and while people think about what question they might want to ask, feel free to line up. I'll just ask one final question to our panelists, which is kind of, where do you see crosswords going in the future? Like, what is the future of crosswords in this country?
So we're in, a second golden age, I think, of crosswords. It was a very interesting study of just how many games were being played over the pandemic. The pandemic meant so much to people who had been longtime solvers but had never tried their hand at constructing. And there was a bit of an explosion in people who were like, I enjoy this. I didn't know I could actually make it not just a hobby, not even just a pastime, but like a job. So the economics of gaming after the strength of the New York Times app, then going into COVID, where games were a real balm for people. And coming out of it, a lot of people that I know who had crosswords as a side hustle have found editorships, whether it's in the mobile app world. So Puzzmo is sort of this Hearst attempt to come for the New York Times gaming dominance. There's just a proliferation of indie blogs, which have been somewhat revenue generating for their creators. And so there's just a huge and growing ecosystem of puzzles where the New York Times is not the only game in town, and in fact, the games in town are like much more easily distributed and solved by all.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I think we focus a lot on how puzzles have changed, and they've changed in like really good ways. They're more diverse. There's a much broader community of people creating and solving them. I think something we'll also see, though, is this kind of sameness that I think is part of what people really like about crossword puzzles is you can do the crossword every day. You kind of know how it works. You know what the rules are. It's going to be there. It's going to have a solution. And I think the routine and the sameness is something people really like about them. And so there's ways in which the crossword hasn't changed that much in the last 100 years. And so I hope that there's some core of this daily constant routine that that doesn't change also. Yeah.
And more people are talking about crosswords and in different media than ever before, I think. I think people have always talked about the puzzle, and the puzzle is an amazing social opportunity, from solving together in the print puzzle to the crossword Discord is really strong right now. And I think that this a community, and it's a community that's very porous, from beginners to the most expert, and solvers and constructors alike. And I think that that feels another both continuation and something that is intergenerational about the crossword, the crossword community that has always existed and continues to become ever more expanding.
Awesome. So let's take some questions, please.
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about loaded, forbidden, or provocative words, either being used as the answers or in the clues, just how that plays out in the context of the New York Times or just in general.
Yeah, excellent. I don't think we've talked about the Sunday morning breakfast test yet.
Yeah, I mean, Margaret Farrar, who was the first editor of the New York Times crossword, so she starts a couple months after Pearl Harbor when the New York Times is like, I think we got to do some games. People are going through it. And has a rule, it's sort of like no death, disease, or war.
Yeah.
And immediately breaks this rule because World War II is just in the puzzle every single day. But it has meant that the Sunday morning breakfast test standard of I ought to be able to solve the puzzle. You know, my kids are nearby. The puzzle should be PG and white bread to the extent it can be. A lot of those rules, first of all, it's a bit of an unsteady standard. It's unclear what one person's shock is when it's another person's idea of a good time. But because there is this sense that the puzzle ought to be solver-centric, there's been a definite movement, at least among constructors our age and younger, to just try and not alienate solvers, right? Now, it really, really depends what we mean by alienate. So there was an answer in a Lynn Lampel puzzle a couple years ago called Clean Coal. And the clue was something about, the clue just made no noises about whether this was in fact a dubious category. And like the climate movement just went nuts, yeah, saying it's not a thing.
Yeah,
and of course,
yeah,
when you have the imprimatur of the New York Times saying, here is a clue, the answer is etched in stone, it feels quite, it feels like an imprint. So the people are very, very much interested in not alienating solvers, but that standard continues to shift as more and more people come into the puzzle and make puzzles for their communities, in which maybe it's okay to have answers that might not fly in the New York Times if you're sending it to your friends or putting it on your blog.
All right, yeah, next question.
Hi, yeah, so my family are all daily players of the New York Times games, including the mini. And we have a group chat where we share our times and compete. And so I'm curious of your take on how something that's as individual as experiencing a crossword can become a shared experience that brings people together.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something we've really seen change. I think it was always common for like families or couples to gather around the kind of breakfast table and work on the puzzle together. But I think in the last few years, we've just seen more and more of this. Like, I think so when the crossword blogs first showed up in like the early kind of 2000s in the New York Times Crossword Forum, it seemed to many people like just a wild thing to do that someone would like every day write down their experience solving the crossword puzzle. Seems so normal now, and at the time it seemed like, wow, like what are these people doing? And so I think we've really seen a shift there, and I think Wordle was so good at getting people to start sending their scores around using that like very clever iconography that I think some of that is carried over to other forums. So I think there was a lot of Wordle group chats where everyone shared their Wordles, and I feel like Wordle's receded a bit, but things like the Mini and Spelling Bee have kind of taken off, and that those same group chats, I think, I'm hearing a lot of that, that the same group chats are places to share times across all of these games. And the New York Times Games app has been really successful.
And there was also a very serendipitous, sadly serendipitous, but moments where like group chats and sharing and these apps also like were rising in popularity just as the pandemic hit. And then the crossword and other games are an incredible form of being alone and being social at the same time. So there were like, and the New Yorker started doing, I think this I know was a serendipitous thing that had happened around the same time, but March, April 2020, you started being able to solve in pairs. The New Yorker, you could solve it in pairs, and like, and so the to your question, like the crossword, the sharing mechanism really took off, especially in the early days of the pandemic, because you are doing this game, you are following isolation, and you are doing it socially all together, and it kind of hit that paradox through these group chats.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'll add is that one of the main things that the puzzle does is there are a lot of people for whom at least I solved the crossword today was a bit of a refrain during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of games, there was an interesting thing of like work was sort of not work anymore, and solving the puzzle, pantomimes work a little bit. You're writing down a lot of it. In fact, a lot of its popularity is that it looks like labor, it looks like an election, but then at the end, you're just like, I solved the game. I think the added thing here was streaks and time. I think it's solving Wordle, you would never text someone, I solved Wordle today. You would text them the narrative, the iconography that says, here's what happened. Here's the story of how I struggled and got it in 5.
Yeah.
Or here's the story of my serendipitous 2 out of 6. And posting how fast you solved a Monday crossword in, even with that thing that says, and it was 2 minutes faster than I'd ever solved it before, give someone a bit of insight, not just into your day that day, but into your growth, your narrative with the crossword. And so I think it's been a bit of a collaboration across time for a lot of people.
Speaking of the Mini and serendipity, if you do today's Mini, two down and 5 down seem serendipitously related to today's.
No spoilers.
Yeah. We did check with Joel Faliano.
I texted Joel. Let me see if he said anything.
Yeah. We don't think it's intentional, but solve today's Mini if you haven't yet.
Yeah. All right, thank you all.
Thanks for the question. Yeah.
So there's been a lot of talk about what makes a good answer, but what I was wondering is what makes a good question?
Should we go to some of the fun clues?
We could go to some of the fun clues. Yeah.
Amazing transition.
Yeah. We didn't plant this.
We've done those.
Close your eyes?
These are fun answers. The fun clues
are...
One.
Well, I can say one while we find it. But a really good... So on Friday and Saturday at the Times and Monday at the New Yorker, linguistic misdirection is kind of the name of the game. And so I think this is a spoiler for one of the crosswords you have. I'm very, very sorry. But one of my favorite answers is... I'll say Will Shortz's favorite crossword clue of all time, which is, it turns into another story. And the answer is... Spiral Staircase, which literally turns into another story. And the misdirections with both, yeah, exactly. It's awe and annoyance is like, and I think a good crossword clue gets at both of those.
So we have some examples here of like award-winning clues, which I think tend to be this variety, which are very clever. Before we get to those, I would say there's also a place for kind of less clever clues that maybe they're kind of share some interesting kind of trivia or they give, I really appreciate clues that give multiple entries into the answer. So something, there's a clue I like NFL team whose mascot is named for a poet, or an NFL team named after a poem, right? And the answer is Ravens. And that gives you these kind of two ways, like maybe you don't know that the Ravens are an NFL team, but you do know that Raven is a famous poem by Edgar Allan Poe, or maybe you...
I want to meet that person.
Yeah. That's right. So these are some fun clues. Should we... you have the answers, right?
I mean, I think we can all figure out the answers. So list of things to try. You got to reparse the word try here, six letters.
Oh.
You know it? Yeah. Oh, these are all there. Oh, no. We have to look through them more closely. So list of things to try is a docket, like a trial docket in the law. Refuse to tap out. Well, that's not right.
Is it refuse?
It's refuse to tap out. So you have to repronounce the word. And then the answer is ashes. Launching pad with the question mark. The question mark always signals a kind of tricky, punny clue. We got 7-4. Anyone know? Launching pad. It's a starter home. Brand for the rest of the people. Try that word rest. Think about that in a different way. Yeah. Serta, I think it's actually Sealy, but Serta would also fit, and so that's a really nice misdirect. Moves in for a short time. Moves here is a noun.
Oh, like a dance craze?
Dance craze, yeah. So dance moves. Upshot.
That does a really nice thing where it switches where in is in the parsing. Yes. And that's a classic tactic.
In meaning, hot, popular. Upshot.
I think I wrote this clue.
What's that?
I think I know this one.
Yeah.
Aerial photo?
Aerial photo. May through mid-July 2019.
So this capitalizes on the fact that the first letter of crossword clues, like a sentence, is capitalized. So May is here a proper noun.
Capitalizes on capitalization.
Exactly.
So this is Prime Minister Theresa May. Yeah, you got it. Yeah.
Nicely done.
One in a semicircle. And also here, I think this trades on the fact that semi is an abbreviation. Is that right?
But does it just mean truck or something?
Yes, but the answer is CBER. And I think because that's an abbreviation, this is one of those cluing conventions that you have to have an abbreviation in the clue to signal an abbreviation in the answer. So it sort of does double duty there. The semicircle is the pun, but also semi is an abbreviation. Synagogue props, 5-3. Someone say it? Mazel tov, yes. Mazel tov.
Yeah.
And toy made with no plastic junk.
I was wrong. There is a Barbie collab.
There is a Barbie collab, yes. Yeah, so this is, of course, Ken. He's just Ken. No plastic junk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That doesn't pass my breakfast.
No?
I don't think it's a Times clue.
I think that was probably from some indie puzzle.
Yeah,
it's
an
Amanda Rifkin
clue. If you want more of the edgy kind of clues, we definitely encourage, like, the AV Club, Queer Crosswords Incubator. The New Yorker's a little edgier, I think, than the New York Times. There's a whole range of solving experiences out there for folks. So, thank you so much. Thanks for being here, and enjoy the puzzles. Yeah.